Okay, let's do this. Software forgery. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, history, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Peter Healy, Daniel Boyd, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. A couple episodes ago, I mentioned the concept of forging software. Let's talk about it. As a member of several software preservation and collecting lists, it's inevitable that I'll find out about controversies, dramas, but a subject I kept seeing mentioned here and there were trying to figure out the accuracy and verification of old vintage software. The term vintage software is one of a family of terms, abandonware, old software, classic software, that people have used to talk about programs that are no longer part of the commercial space. A lot of this is complicated by remakes and reissues, but we're generally talking about things that came in a box on floppies or CD-ROMs, and are not digitally distributed and are not updated with high-definition graphics or reimagined sound. So the original plastic, cardboard, and dead media versions of software. Most of my time in that realm is spent trying to track down specimens of titles and creations that otherwise are not known to exist. That is, they're in pages and reviews and people know about them, but the versions most people have are the pirated, cracked, modified versions instead of the original, untouched ones. And as time goes on and the media starts to die, we're concerned, legitimately concerned, that those originals are going to fade away. Everybody who used an Apple II has heard of Choplifter. And everyone who used an Atari 800 heard of Jumpman, titles that are seminal, part of the lore of the platform. But surprisingly, actual, untouched, able-to-be-imaged versions are sometimes completely unavailable. So when somebody offers me access to a storage unit that hasn't been opened for years, or the contents of their parents' attic after they're gone, there's a very good chance that there could be something within we haven't seen in the world for a very long time. I've had people offer me collections mostly to try to sell them to me or to ask me how much they're worth, and I just have to tell them that's not my department. And I get it. I mean, I understand the narrative that old things have value, and because they might be like rare antiques, turning something that's been sitting around in your family's life for decades and turning it into something that can make your life better, that's an entirely valid idea. It's just not one I'm going to help you with. As you can imagine, the rise of Craigslist and eBay have led to an idea that everything has a price, that if you get your hands on anything old, you can at least put it up for sale and see what happens. As luck would have it, there have been multiple cases of people showing extreme interest in certain titles, in certain places, in certain names being attached to equipment. Real money for it, thousands or tens of thousands of dollars. Well, that'll make anybody stand up and notice. Rare old computers, especially with stories attached to them, this is the first computer of its type, this is the only known prototype, this was owned by this famous person. Well, they make bank. Folks pay money. And wherever you see people pay money, you're going to have a lot of sketchiness. So that brings me to forgery. The original, old-school computer forgery is what we call vaporware. That's where you offer a software package or hardware package and it doesn't exist. If people on the buying side are lucky, it doesn't exist because you still need the money people are pouring in to make it happen. This is certainly what happened with one of the most popular first computers, the Altair, which was just an empty box that appeared on a magazine cover and started off the microcomputer revolution, totally based on people giving them enough money to actually make the thing they promised. Offering people things that don't exist, well, that goes back way longer than computers, and it's going to go way past what we think of as computers today. Whether we call it a special pre-order, a getting-on-the-ground investment, you're offering people nothing for something in the promise that it will become something in the very near future. Sitting in the pages of digitized magazines on the archive are lots of ads, articles, and reviews for items that were changed pretty significantly between the promises and the fulfillment. Some call that business as usual. I totally get in the crunch between perception, hope, and reality, some things are going to change. But it doesn't take long for people to bank, literally bank, on that expectation, to overpromise, to underdeliver, to have a cover artist create a beautiful vision of the software inside, totally obscuring the dots, lines, and flickering that reality was going to bring. But I'm definitely dancing around what I'm getting at, which is the skyrocketing value of original, old-school software that has happened in the past 10 or 15 years. There are a number of titles where everyone knows the name and the concept of a pristine, new inbox, shrink-wrapped version of the software is alluring. Not because you want to open it up and learn from it, and not because it's amazing it survived for this long, but because there is a precedent for the idea of a consumer product that is completely brand new and can be traded on its rarity, quality, and volume. I'm speaking, of course, of comic books and collectibles, where there is an entire other industry and society based around putting these comic books into sealed boxes with certifying bodies, giving them grade systems on the quality of the box and exactly how little damage it has so that people can sell them. This is a whole thing. Once you've turned it into an abstract object inside of a box with a foundation of certifying bodies, it's not really a game anymore. It's just a token representing its own worth by how much people are paying for it, and then using how much people paid for it to make other people pay even more for it over time. The idea of it acquiring value simply by its own existence and how much value has been poured into it before. It doesn't matter what it is. Doesn't matter if it's a comic book, a piece of vinyl, or a computer software package. This token is an investment. So naturally, if it's become an abstract ideal, a meaningless token, it would stand to reason there would be enough incentive to take the time to make a fake one. This isn't the case of people making cheap printing that looks like original software and selling it in electronic stores or flea markets for the purposes of making a quick buck. No, that exists, and I can tell you, as a software historian, I've come into contact with some of these products, and they are truly amazing to behold, works of art in themselves. But what if you're trying to convince people that you have something original that was made 35 years ago? How would you even do that? Well, it helps to work yourself into the community in a way that makes it look like you're totally legitimate. Folks will set up eBay accounts and sell used software only for the purpose of building up a reputation. Really cheap stuff, really easy to find, and then, over time, somebody will make an announcement. They have an original package that only 100 to 200 copies are known to have ever existed, and which came from the very hands of the creator, or the very first shop, now long gone, that was carrying it. They'll provide pictures, and it will look in every way like the original software. It'll be in a baggie with inexpensively produced paper, utilizing floppy disks that look like they came from that period of time. And here's where it gets interesting. I've sat in conversations where people have looked at these pictures and said, "You know, I don't think this is legitimate. That's not the sticker for the price that was on the original store packaging. That's not a baggie that was manufactured in 1980. I don't think that disc could possibly have come from that period." So it was that somebody was selling an original Ultima predecessor made by Richard Garriott, which had a floppy disk and a baggie and a sticker that everyone said looked a little bit suspicious. Adding to the suspicion was the story by the seller that overuse of the floppy disk had clean wiped all of the data off of the disk, making it essentially blank and unreadable, and that it was only his own promise that this was an original floppy that we all had to depend on. They were putting it up for hundreds of dollars and selling it as if it was brand new, in box, never touched, except for when it came from the hands of Richard Garriott at the store he was selling it at. Now, the ruse fell apart because somebody who was from that actual store looked at it and found a variety of things that didn't ring true. The printing, the paper quality, the way the photographs portrayed it. This thing was being done by somebody who had never been there, who was using pictures off the internet to construct a fabricated, forged software copy. The completely scientifically inaccurate magnetism story just was the icing on the cake, the kind of story that a person can look you in the eye when they're selling you a car and claim to you that there was no damage done to it. That grifter strength, the ability to tell people to their face a provable, bald-faced lie and get away with it. People started to trace that the person who was selling this was the same guy who, under another name, had tried the scam before, and within no time at all, the tornado of online hatred got the eBay item delisted for fraud. So if you were wondering when that line was going to be crossed, muddied further by forgers, counterfeiters, and folks inventing things out of thin air, well, we've passed it. Years and years ago, and it doesn't look like we're getting back. Discerning counterfeit works is going to be a louder and louder background noise in this activity going forward. The archive played a part in an attempt to misportray the history of a game for the purposes of promotion. They uploaded a program that meant to look like it was from 1989, and it was only the inclusion and reference to Windows libraries that didn't exist till a few years later that we noticed what was going on. The idea, of course, was that in the cacophony of current Steam offerings, somebody was trying to make a game that would stand out as being a rescued piece of lost history, and they were doing their best to lay the groundwork for making it look like this game once existed and had been completely lost and then rediscovered. People figured it out, people exposed it, and what was meant to be kind of a harmless retro idea had ramifications of how do we trust anything. And the answer is we don't. As somebody who doesn't really make it his business to work in business with vintage software, I don't really care about any of this noise. What matters to me is that, as best we can, staying out ahead of this growing tidal wave of monetization of history, we get pretty good copies of everything that came before, without judging its worth as auction material or even its commercial value. Just taking it all in, scanning it all in, imaging the floppies, recording the cassettes, before we lose it all to rot, to entropy, or, I'm sad to say, the loud, echoing gavel of an online auction. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to Wayne Arthurton, Scott McGrady, Scott Roseanne, Forrest Fuqua, Emilio Oliveira, Mark Pilgrim, and James Bekoyanu, along with the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere, who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. Make no mistake, even though I don't play in it, try to get involved in it, I'm always fascinated by the amount of human effort that can go into fraud, forgery, puffery, and lies. The amount of work people will do to stay out ahead of people discovering that fraud has happened, I mean, I find it fascinating. There are these beautiful cases of fraudsters being found out, and then for that last 6 or 7 weeks before they finally disappear, they double down, they triple down, they quadruple down and tell everyone about conspiracy and incompetence, that is, making everyone think that what something is what it is. If you've chosen to turn fraud and grifting into your means of support, along with it comes a separation from the human race. You have to think of them as suckers, as people you can take advantage of. You can't soften your stance level with anybody, because then the whole game is up. That is the price for playing that game. Telling folks the truth about historical items I find, about my emotions and how I feel, about the day-to-day difficulties or triumphs of being alive, that's quite enough for me.